He got that. And in fact, evolution was not picked up on initially, widely in science, because of that concern. Well, how does it happen? We're not sure yet. There's a hole. Then we get Mendel, who in fact, stuff was around at the time, but you know, it took a little while for someone to put the two together and find it. And there were other wonderful predictions. Well, now we've got that. There must be a method by which that information is encoded. We get DNA. We get the double helix turning up, meeting the prediction. Not surprisingly, because we were looking for it. That's one thing science does, of course. You do tend to find what you're looking for. And then we thought we need a mechanism by which the information turns itself into expression, into the next generation of biologists. So it seems to me lots of predictions had occurred. But it's really nice that there's a New Zealand link here. Early 70s, two scientists starting out from their career, Mike Hendy and David Penny, now working at the Alan Wilson Centre. And they said, hey, we're starting to get to the stage where we can read stretches of the genome. So I reckon we can now make a unique prediction about data that nobody knows about yet, but we will know about soon. I reckon if evolution is correct, at least in terms of common ancestry and, you know, and that the tree, if you like, of life, if that's true, then we predict you will find patterns in the non-coding sections of DNA. You will find patterns that match also the patterns in the, you know, what we see as the tree. These birds are more closer to those birds than they are to that orangutan type stuff. They said, well, surely, if these splits have occurred, then over time, the almost random accumulation of mutations in the non-coding sequences will start to reflect how long they've been apart for. And they made some quite tight predictions before any measurement was done. And they did it in response to Popper's challenge. They said, that's a good challenge, it's a reasonable challenge, let's see if we can answer it. Great science, all of that. Stuff to be proud of. The New Zealand links with the DNA, with Rutherford, with Hendy and, you know, Penny. Why wouldn't we be proud to be down here doing great science? Evolutionary psychology. It doesn't feel like any of those stories to me. One aspect does. So let me make the distinction if I can. Here's the part of evolutionary psychology that seems entirely reasonable. The thing that says, hey, we are evolved. Our brains are the product, in the end, of the way our genes express themselves, interact with the environment, and the curious, wonderful sort of chaotic feedback loops. Okay, that seems reasonable. We take that as a starting point and say, can that tell us anything about the brain? And it clearly will be able to. It's clearly going to be worth comparing in great detail differences between human and chimp genomes, looking for those differences and seeing if we can work out how they're expressing in the brain. Clearly it's worth looking at things like particular behavioural traits, longitudinal studies like the one in Dunedin, looking at really rich data about how people's lives have turned out and the traits, and then comparing that to their genome and looking for patterns. That all seems sensible stuff to me. And it is evolutionary psychology. It's saying, I believe we are evolved, therefore the implication is that much of how we behave will be influenced by, for instance, our genome and its expression and its interaction with the environment, and working all that stuff out is cool. But notice at no stage does anyone doing that work have to talk about the Pleistocene or the savanna, or, you know, or the way, you know, reproductive success of angry men, etc., etc. We don't have to tell stories about the environment in which we evolved. We just say, we take evolution as given. Does that tell us then some places to start looking to explain the way we think? That's cool. But there is another form, isn't there, of evolutionary psychology, which says, here's a theory I've got about how human beings behave, and I'm going to match it to a story I can tell you about some weird stuff that I reckon happened on the African plains. And that, to me, has got nothing to do with science whatsoever. But that's the sort of stuff that says, I'm going to explain to you now why successful stories have the following characteristics. It's because storytelling, you see, evolved as a mechanism for blah, blah, blah. And then you make up something. A mechanism for encoding and passing on important information to young people in a way that, as a mechanism for keeping people awake when they were scared of being attacked by lions, and in particular, this moment in the story when is to do with the lion. It's like, yeah, maybe. Unlikely. How the hell would you know? And the thing that really amazes me about evolutionary psychology is how rich the stories of the savannah become. You wouldn't be, it would be absolutely fair to start believing that we had CCTV cameras there, right? They tell us things like, well, of course, women, in order to be reproductively successful, must ensure their children stay alive. After all, they can only have so many in a lifetime. True, reasonable, nothing wrong there. Men, to be reproductively successful, must have as many children as possible. Okay, I can see where you're going mathematically. I'm still okay. Therefore, the successful man will have been more aggressive in order to outcompete. Why? You sure? You sure the cooperative but sneaky man wouldn't have done better? Really? Why wouldn't the aggressive scare the bejesus out of all the other women do incredibly well under those circumstances? Is there any reason to believe one of those is a better story than the other? No. None at all. Unless you were there. And I reckon they weren't. So how do you test that? Well, how they often test it is by going to measure aggression rates amongst men and women here. And that's bollocks, because at that point, what you're actually doing is saying, I think men are more aggressive than women. Let's find out. We'll go and test some. What on earth has evolutionary psychology doing? It's just a hang-on. Now, one of the tenets of science is let's keep it as elegant and simple as possible. Don't go throwing extra bits in the theory that don't do anything. You know, what about this one about, I think all people around the world appreciate the same forms of art, and they all like particular pictures. Where on earth does that come from? And even worse, I've heard that one taken to the next step, and the next step is, and that shows that this is an evolved preference. You know, that backs up evolution. Two things. Evolution doesn't need artists backing it up, okay? The theory's pretty solid. But the second thing that's much important is it doesn't back it up. Because if you're some loopy creationist who believe the white-bearded guy did it 3,000 years ago, that also absolutely predicts the possibility of universal tastes in art. He made you that way. So you see, it's not actually a unique prediction at all. In fact, the two don't hang together at all. So sometimes I ask these questions. Is it because social sciences just have extreme science envy? You know? Is that the deal? Is this what we're dealing with here? Is it people saying, I'm a little bit embarrassed about the fact that I make my living writing weird theories about books? It's sort of crap, and I don't know what's going to happen when my kids have what my dad does at school days, because it's not as cool as being a fireman. What if I was really a scientist? So my next book about literature will include 5 chapters on evolution. Then I'll go and show you all the stuff I always say about literature, and I'll hope that you assume the two are connected. It could be that. But I've also found, and working amongst biologists, they're reasonably seduced by it too, often. So maybe they have storytelling envy. Maybe they think, my science isn't that sexy. Because for it to be pure, it must reduce to, basically, models, mathematical models, predictive models. I'm not allowed to say any of the outrageous stuff that gets the journalists running. So I don't get in the news as much. Damn. But if I could show a biological, an evolutionary basis of racism, I'd be front page. Maybe it's about that. Maybe it's just the journalists are crap. I mean, that's the other group you could blame, right? It could be that some of these theories are much more sophisticated than they get reported on. But I'm a bit suspicious of that last point. Hey, you shouldn't be kept beyond, your break time. And it's much more fun if you ask questions. And if someone out there is going, you've got it all wrong. I get evolutionary psychology, you don't. Here's your moment.
Here's your moment. So I'll start.
Yeah.
Because it's called the theory of evolution.
Yep.
There's my starting point. It can never be proved. That hasn't been proved, otherwise it would be called the rule of evolution, and therefore it cannot be true science, it can only be explanatory.
So you're now saying evolution isn't true science?
Well, it's a theory. It's a theory of relativity.
Yeah, you're right.
It's not the principle. Newton has principles and rules.
Well, actually...
But it's still called a theory. So that's the reason why. That's the reason. Yeah.
Can I talk about it? Or
of course.
Isn't language a fun thing? It is absolutely true. Physics, the pompous gits that they are, do have rules and laws. It's not because they're law-like or rule-like. It's just they call them that. I think biologists are just more modest, and so they call it a theory. Words, though, however, having said that, for any of you who follow the evolution creationism debate, will understand that words are terribly are terribly dangerous things. And that word theory couldn't be more dangerous, could it, when it's unleashed on the public. Because we understand that scientists hold the word theory fairly sacred. A theory is a hypothesis with some pretty good evidence about it.
Yeah?
That's, wow, that's a good thing. You don't sneeze at a theory in science. But out in the world, out in the real world, where people just go, no, it's the truth, it's a fact. It's a fact that if fuck hadn't been dropped then. because they use that word, and then theory is for, oh, it's a, you know, that's just your theory. That in the end is because I think philosophically in the West, we are still hung up on Plato and we're still hung up on absolute truth. We believe that there's this, some people believe there's this knowable truth out there, and therefore the word fact is sensible. Fact is pretty sensible as our best guess, something that's a reasonable, reliable prediction generator. That's what we really mean by fact. If I say, you know, something like, it's a fact that if I drop this rock on my foot, it's going to hurt, I'm just making a prediction. And it's a prediction based on what I've seen in other people, what I understand of the rock, and my own past experiences. That's all a fact, you know, sort of is. And in that sense, let there be no mistake, evolution is a wonderful fact about the world. It's just, I think, that we're scientists are cautious enough to use a far smarter word, and I think theory is a much smarter word.
Well, theory means an explanation in science, really, in that sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Theory of relativity is an explanation.
Yeah.
Needs rebranding.
Yeah, I mean, which PR firm would you give it to, dear?
All right, so let's get going here.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a second.
Okay,
just an evolutionary psychology story, which some of you may have heard, but I'll go with it anyway, and you might appreciate it. There was a company in England which brought out a set of maps on the basis that it had nice directional stuff for all the men, and it had little landmarks for all the women. Because we know that men operate by direction. You ask them, you know, how do I get to so-and-so, and they'll say, oh, you go north 2 blocks, turn east, and you're there. And women will go, you what? And the lady with them will then say to her, oh, it's okay, you go up as far as the big tree, turn right at the red letterbox. Thank you. Right. Sounds fine. We've all been there, those of us who have had partners of one form or another and argued over how to get around Europe with an A to Z guy. Evolutionary psychology said this is because man on the savannah was busy trundling out for days after chasing the lions and the gazelles and whatnot and had to navigate by generalized rules using the sun and directions. Whereas women who weren't in the savannah back at the caves were checking out where the mushrooms were and having to remember we need to be over by that big rock in the spring to dig up the roots. Hence the difference, gender-based differences explained by evolutionary psychology. Good story? Sounds sensible?
Nah. Yeah, sure.
The same thing happens in mice. They have gender differences based on landmark and directional movements. Go figure. Just those stories.
Nice. Yeah. That's a fantastic example.
Yeah.
I'd like to know what happened with the interview.
Did you
go up your nuts or did you keep it polite?
We're the right staff.
Just say you're an asparagus.
I told them a star sign and they were delighted because the one I'd randomly chosen was compatible with all of them. They offered me the job, they had to clear it with Helen Clark's office, and for reasons unknown I wasn't cleared. And I'm sort of delighted in hindsight.
I have a question. So are there things that could be predicted by evolution in psychology? Because I think you were referring to Dutton before, yes? when you were talking about art.
Maybe.
And he was asked, can't be predicted? And he said, yes, they can. Yep. But I can't recall what he said. And our experiments are only where they are at the moment in terms of evolution being a theory. Copernicus would have said, well, it's a fact. It's not a theory.
I absolutely think, well, two things. One, I think there are really interesting predictions to come out of that level of, once you're in an evolutionary mindset, you are going to start making predictions about the way genes and environment interact. And I think they're really interesting and really testable, and that's what I like about it. But it hasn't got the story hang on. I think your question is, can the story part generate?
Yeah.
I think two things. There is maybe, although it's incredibly hard, I don't think the data is ever going to be rich enough myself because you're reverse engineering. Mm. It is possible to look at how our brain works, etc., as we get better at it, and say, I wonder if this means something about our evolutionary past, and then go hunting. Now, how do you go hunting into the past? Well, looking at the genome is an example. You know, they, so the stuff they do at the Alan Wilson Center. In fact, using current, if you like, written code, you know, these guys are looking at things like in what order was the Pacific populated. Things that happened thousands of years ago by looking at the genetic code of things like, you know, rats and so forth. So there may be that potential. I mean, the most famous sort of prediction of the evolutionary psych folk is this idea of the segmented brain, of the brain that, you know, the pocket knife brain, rather than being a holistic thing. They say, looking at how we think the human brain evolved and some of the assumptions we make about what happened post-common ancestor with the chimp, we reckon that's a really good reason to suspect that the brain doesn't work nearly as holistically as people have thought. It actually works in little chunks. I wonder if they're claiming too much, which is to say, I wonder if that same prediction could have been generated by a lot of different theories. Mm. You know, but I think it's that sort of thing where, you know, I don't think you can mock the whole idea of what would make someone reproductively successful in the past. And can we find any links to that here? I'm just worried that mostly we look at what we already know here, or even worse, what our prejudices are about here, then go and tell the story. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I don't think it's over. Mm-hmm. I absolutely think there's some really interesting work to be done. And I don't think we'll know until our understanding of the brain gets heaps better. And I reckon that may well throw up new puzzles to which evolutionary answers lead to the next tests. You know, so I wouldn't for a moment dismiss the field. That would be foolish, but gosh, there's some foolish stuff in it.
One more question.
All right.
Yeah.
What do you think of the work of primatologists comparing behaviour patterns in other primates in perhaps similar environments to our ancestors?
Well, David Penny, who I worked with, loves this stuff. Franz de Waal is an example, isn't he, of someone... I still have this problem with it. I remember him doing that really famous one with chimpanzees where they were offered rewards for doing something. And there were two types. At first, everybody was offered one reward, and they were all happy to take the reward and do the task. And I can't remember what the first reward is. But the second reward is a grape. And a grape they liked much more than the first reward. And what he noticed was, if he gave them two of them in the same cage against each other, these first rewards, they'd do the task happily. But then if he substituted a grape for one and not the other, that one got really peeved and refused to do the job that it would have previously done. I'm no longer working for a walnut, you bastard. He's getting a grape. That's sort of cool. There's something interesting about that. But when I read an article by him on that, and he may have written many other times on it, the article I read on it, my great concern was the way he then trumpeted that about, look what I've just discovered about humanity. He said, this is a core piece of human nature. It was already there in our common ancestor. It must have been, etc. And there are two problems with that. First is, I reckon if you want to know whether humans get peeved by relative reward, it's probably smarter to study humans under those conditions, you know? And the second one, of course, is you can't assume just because it's there in chimpanzees that the intervening millions of years, and this remarkable emergence of language culture hasn't had a really remarkable effect on it. But I reckon some of the language stuff's going to be interesting. I mean, isn't the thing that unlocks the code in a way, where the hell did language come from? Under what circumstances did we start talking? And to whom? Daniel Dennett suggests we started talking to ourselves, the self-talk function. Not a crazy idea. But unlocking that's going to be fascinating, I reckon, because I think so much of the human mind is a language mind, but I would say that I'm a writer. And I think studying chimps, one, what their language capacity is, and two, what's going on in terms of genome difference, it's going to be really... I think there's great potential there.
Thank you. You have got us thinking.